And of these three pillows or pillars of the study, I think mine is mostly concerned with the transition part, how to go from here to something else. And the focus is on climate change and on renewable energy and the transition from fossil energy to renewable energy, which of course is a central part of this overall transition. And the departure or the starting point of this little inquiry is, well, the obvious fact that this system, capitalism, or call it what you like, is acting against right now the long-term interest of pretty much anyone. And it's going really bad, and we know that, and it's kind of shocking to actually realize that it is going very bad, and that the ones in power still get away with it, and we let them get away with it. So how is that? How does it come? How can we possibly stop this? That kind of seems to be the most interesting question, or the most important question that we have to address right now. So let's start with looking at how come, how do we usually explain that we have a climate change and that nothing very much is done about it. Some will say it's about the human nature, that we started to use fire and the climate change is kind of the result, end result of that. I think it's quite a stupid explanation, of course, because we, the global society, whatever, have been living without dangerous climate change for tens and tens and thousands of years, and this has been a problem for the last decades. So we'll just go further. That is not, I think, a serious explanation. Is it about lack of information? Do we not know enough of the risks with climate change? No, that is probably not the case, actually. Most of us know enough to take action, and there are polls, etc., that show that we know enough. We should know enough to know that this is a dangerous situation and to act upon it. But what is really difficult, according to sociologists, etc., is that we tend to ignore it because we don't see how we can influence things, that our contribution seems to be meaningless. So how do we live with that? How do we get on with knowing about this disaster and not doing anything about it? Well, one way would be to make sure, of course, that we are not to blame. We kind of need the support of others to make us believe that and to make us sure of that. So a Norwegian, half American sociologist, Kari-Marie Norgard, has called this that we have a kind of a socially organized denial. We know about this, but we convince ourselves commonly that it's beyond our scope of action. I think I have a definition here: the active organization of information about global warming in such a way that it remains outside the sphere of everyday reality, a distant problem rather than a local political issue. And if this is the case, we have a problem, of course, and has that something to do particularly with climate change? Yeah, according to Stephen Gardiner, for instance, a philosopher, he would say that there are climate change represents a kind of a perfect storm, perfect moral storm, which is the coincidental coming together of different factors that amplifies the crisis. And he talks about the global storm, which is the spatial division of causes and effects regarding climate change. So we emit here, like in Scandinavia, but the effects are perhaps happening at the African Horn right now. We're in Syria. So this is a kind of a disincentive for us to act here because of the spatial divisions. And there's also an intergenerational storm, so temporal division, because we emit a lot now, but some of the consequences will happen much later. So that leads to a disincentive for us to act now, and for every generation to actually procrastinate any actions. And then he also talks about the theoretical storm and then the division within science between natural science and social science and so on. So we have a kind of a problem here that makes action on climate change particularly difficult. But still, I would argue that there are examples of such storms that have been transcended historically, and I'm thinking of, for instance, the ozone layer, which was more or less saved due to an agreement in Montreal from 1987, which was quite effective actually in addressing these problems. And it was also a global problem and a generational problem and a theoretical problem. So what's different about climate change then? Well, I think scale is different. Fossil fuels are much more, you know, widespread and used than the substance that deplete the ozone layer. And there's also a difference in centrality to the very production system. I mean, fossil fuels is used everywhere, and it's very, you know, you need it almost to have an industrial civilization. While refrigerators, etc., are more marked that use these substances, freon and so on, they are much more marginal to the economy. And finally, there is the question of technology substitution. Can we do anything? We can't do very much about the scale of fossil fuel. We can't do very much about the centrality of it in capitalist production. But what about technology? Is there? Can we think of technology as helping us out here? That there will emerge a technology that makes it possible to actually stop using fossil fuels without a revolution or something like that in the social sphere. And if you go into that, you find basically two discourses, which I call the techno-optimist discourse, which I think you read a lot of in the paper right now. There's this record levels now of solar PVs and wind turbines, and we see new electric cars, etc. So it seems like, well, the problems are going to be solved, etc. And if we only let like the market rule and support new technology, we're going to fix this. And this discourse then focus very much on technology substitution, not on, for instance, conservation to reduce the amount of energy needed or something, but new technology. And basically they say, like these two American scientists, that there are barriers to 100% conversions to wind, wave and solar power, but they are not technological, they're not economical, they're social and political. That's the barriers. But then this discourse seldom go any further. They don't problematize these social and political barriers. And then we have the techno-pessimist discourse, which is a bit more marginal perhaps, but I think you heard of it too, that sure, they would say like emissions, there are new solar cells, solar PVs, but they're not very environmental friendly. They depend on industrial technology, and still the emissions are rising. So this is not really, nothing is changing. It's just like a mirror. It's just like something. In a deep sense, we need a different kind of approaches to actually attack this problem, and they will perhaps then talk of conservation rather than technology substitution and degrowth of energy use or degrowth of the economy, and also even like collapse, that we need a collapse of the industrial civilization in order to actually solve this problem. So a problem with this discourse, I would say, that it's not really problematizing social and political relations. It imagines that we could transcend this industrial civilization and go to some kind of degrowth without creating much of social tensions and so on. So perhaps there is a room for a kind of third standpoint that would be rather optimist about technology, but pessimist about capitalism's ability to actually provide this global society with the right technology and to disseminate it in at the scale that is necessary. That's what I try to elaborate on in this text. And so if we take this question serious, what are the social and political barriers of actually creating is a 100% system of renewable energy? Not just stop at the questions, kind of. So, of course, there are these problems that I was talking about, the perfect storms and that the fact that people tend to perhaps deny that they have an influence on this. And another problem, of course, is vested interest and the fossil capital who have invested billions and billions in production of oil and gas and so on, and they have their business models and they will fight till as much as they can and do already and have done for many, many years to stop any renewable transition, transition to renewable energy. But I would also say that there is something else. And I tried then to identify four barriers that are more like internal to how capitalism and how capitalistic economy works. And I've lost time, but I have a few minutes, I think. And one I call the Lauderdale paradox, which is actually an early 19th century political economist in England, James Maitland of Lauderdale, who wrote on the difference between public wealth and private riches, and noted that while public wealth can exist in abundance, air, fresh water, etc., in order to create private wealth, you have to have something that exists in scarcity, right? You can't make money from anything that is abundant. And Foster calls this then that there's nothing more dangerous to capitalism as a system than abundance. And if we look at today's energy system, we can see that they are dependent on input of scarce resources like oil, gas, coal, uranium in the case of nuclear power. And these are stock fuel energy that is extracted, they are commodified, they are sold and transported around the world, and there's a long chain of people making profits in this chain. But while we look at most forms of renewable energies, they are flowing from abundant resources. They are using wind, they are using sea, the water in the seas, or stream water. They are using sun, which are more or less abundant resources, and which are then difficult to enclose and to commodify and to profit from. So a renewable energy system would cut out at least some of the profits that are made now from fossil fuels, and it could perhaps deliver as much public wealth, as much energy for people, but not as much private riches. So that might be a barrier that is identified by the energy utility companies, and which would like kind of raise the resistance against this kind of shift. A second barrier is called here the attraction of spatio-temporal fixes, and it goes back to the research of Andreas Malm on the transition to steam power, and actually the transition from renewable energy to fossil energy in the 19th century. And he is also one of the authors in this compilation of book, in this book, but on another team. He's a colleague of mine at Lund University. So he could see that this past transition from dependence in the British textile industry on dependence on water and partly wind was not about really costs or that the steam power became cheaper than using water in the textile industry, but rather it was about control over labor supply and control over energy supply, because the waterfalls that they were using before, they were free of use, but they were unreliable. They were dependent on, you know, how much had it been raining and the level of water in the magazines and so on. And also the labor force, which was the large reservoir of labor was within the cities, and the waterfalls was generally out in the countryside. So in order to get the labor force to these places where the energy conditions were good, perhaps you had to pay better. You couldn't rely on an abundance of labor that would put a downward pressure on wages and so on. So he talks about the need for of capital, of abstract space to be independent on the whimsical nature and rain and other the seasons and so on, and to be able to control the inflow of energy. And that was the main advantage of fossil fuels, actually. You stock it in a barrel and put it to use whenever you like. You can put it on, you can put it off. And also abstract time. Capitalism relies on abstract time. This kind of turn to abstract space and abstract time is now a generalized pattern. Globalization, as we know it, of course, is about finding the best places of production, mostly where labor is cheapest. And there is a precondition that we don't speak of very much, that to be able to put production in China, for instance, you need stock fuels that is transportable anywhere. If you were, for instance, relying on renewable energy would have perhaps have the lowest price in Sahara, where there's a lot of sun but no labor. So this is actually also a kind of barrier, can be a barrier for a shift to a renewable energy system for capitalism. The third barrier that I discuss is the fear of decentralization, right? And because that's a promise that we tend to hear and that the advocates of renewable energy, they emphasize that this is much more decentralized system, and it's better for a lot of reasons, not only that it produces clean energy, also breaks down all hierarchies and big fossil fuel companies, etc. But I mean, that's good from their perspective, but it's bad for capitalism, right? It's bad for monopoly capital, who are used to control the chain of production in huge corporations. So they realized already in the 50s, I think, the U.S. Senate decided not to go for solar, but rather to invest in nuclear power, because they saw this as a potential imperial tool. They could control the flows of energy, and with solar power, it's much easier technology that could be set up by almost anyone anywhere. And if you want monopolized control, that's not very good. It's like a horror. And finally, my fourth barrier is not so much actually about capitalism, how it works per se, but the fact that the biggest challenge to this system ever is occurring at a specific time in human history when we are particularly unable to deal with it due to this neoliberal phase of capitalism, with its disarmament and of institution of regulatory power. And this is one of the points that is made by Naomi Klein in her book, This Changes Everything, that we are right in this crisis tend to happen at the wrong moment of time, because just 30 or 40 years ago, during what is sometimes called Fordism, states were more relying on top-down regulation. They had these Keynesian ideas of economics, and they had stronger tax regimes and so on, while now most of these systems are deregulated, and the state has weakened, and what is always emphasized is market allocation and commodification. And that seemed to be not very effective means or policies in this transition. And you can actually see that I mentioned before the problems with the ozone layer and the Montreal Agreement from 1987, which was pre or semi neoliberal, perhaps. It didn't only apply market regulation and market systems, but more, tougher regulation. You should phase that out, and you should use that instead. And actually, it seemed to have been more effective in reducing emissions of greenhouse gases than the Kyoto Protocol, that was specifically set up to target these emissions of greenhouse gases, but applied another set of policies, which was much more market regulated, and so on. Finally, I also tried to kind of turn this picture around and see that none of these barriers that I'm discussing are, necessarily insurmountable. And they might be some kind of global green neo-Fordist regulation, and we discussed that also in the book. That can probably be done without threatening capital accumulation as such, but it's interesting to see these barriers. How would they confront another kind of system that is more of a socialist system? And then this Lauderdale paradox, that should be reversed. That would not be a barrier, but reversed into an enticement. Because then energy abundance would, of course, be an advantage. If the aim is the general good, the fact that much of the energy is free, that's an advantage, not a barrier. And if we look over this spatio-temporal fixes, we can see that any definition of socialism would include some kind of labor control over the means of production or labor influence, and that would be facilitated by a socialist system to have a particular place and a particular workforce dealing with these problems. So it wouldn't be a barrier either. And of course, decentralization could also be harbored much more better by a socialist system than by capitalism. I have a long Marx quote too, but perhaps I'm running out of time. But in a way, it seems like this centralized, monopolized capitalism is becoming a feather upon the mode of production, the development toward a more decentralized renewable energy system. And some of you would perhaps recognize a quote by Marx that ends with the centralization of the means of production and socialization of labor at last reach a point where they become incompatible with their capitalist integument, and this integument is burst asunder. The knell of capitalist private property sounds, the expropriators are expropriated. It actually fits rather good into this quote. So, by just summing up, by pointing out and explaining this, the capitalist and other barriers in operation here, I think the political inaction might appear as less irrational and understandable, and to point this out would actually perhaps be a first step toward the dissolution of what Kari Marie Norgaard calls this socially organized denial, and actually create would encourage involvement for political change rather than to be paralyzed by this the picture of that you can't really do anything. At least that's what I hope. So when resistance is seen as meaningful and as potentially influential, then probably mass political action will occur more easily. And whether it leads to socialism or if socialism is even necessary for successfully dealing with climate change, that's beyond what we could know, of course. But I think this would lead to us would be a struggle towards a more social inclusive kind of society, whatever we would label it. It's another question. So thank you.